Kevin Pina is a journalist and filmmaker, has been living and reporting from Haiti for the last 70 years. He's on the ground in Port-au-Prince to give us an unfiltered report on today's presidential election in Haiti. Hello, Kevin.
Yeah, now I can hear you fine. How are you, Jeffrey?
I'm fine. Yesterday, Haiti held its first election since the U.S. coup against President Aristide. The U.S. media says the voting was largely peaceful and went way into the night, but I've heard from other reports that in some poor neighborhoods like City of Soleil, where people were expected to vote for René Préval, a former prime minister under President Aristide, that there weren't enough polling places. What's the scoop?
Well, it said that not only were there not enough polling places, but polling places opened 3 to 4 hours late. The only place where polling stations opened on time was in the wealthy suburb of Pétionville, where, of course, the turnout was expected to help their closest rival to René Préval, Charles Henry Baker, who is a wealthy sweatshop owner, who's been polling at 10% of the vote. So the only place where the polling stations opened on time were in Pétionville, and that was expected to favor Baker. And everywhere else, they opened 3 to 4 hours late. There were huge protests about that. Some voters began stoning some of the polling sites. Delma 17, the police had to use tear gas in order to control the crowd. And the United Nations used tear gas as well. It was very chaotic. It was a very awful start to these elections. And, of course, a lot of the people in the poor neighborhoods believe that this was done intentionally. They believe that it was done in order to soften the vote for René Préval and increase the vote for his closest rival, sweatshop owner Charles Henry Baker.
Now, where does Baker come from?
Well, Baker is Haitian-American. He was born in the United States, but he's lived here most of his life. A very wealthy family. His father was a white businessman here, came from the United States, married an African woman here. Basically, he's among the elite class, the few families that run this economy. He was also one of the co-founders of the Group 184, which was a so-called civil society groups and organizations that were heavily funded by the United States, France, and Canada to foment the ouster against democratically elected President Jean-Bertrand Aristide.
Now, it's interesting, the National Public Radio has been doing a series on Haiti, and today, this morning, they referred to Aristide as having fled Haiti or being toppled, but there's no mention of the U.S. role in that. Perhaps you could go over that quickly.
Well, the United States, through the International Republican Institute, through the National Endowment for Democracy, and that whole intricate web of non-governmental organizations, helped to fund and build the opposition to Aristide. Now, the interesting thing is that there was a recent CID Gallup poll in December, and what that Gallup poll inadvertently exposed was that the candidates who are running representing the movement that ousted Aristide are polling at less than 30%. So actually, they had the press, the mainstream media, the corporate media, including NPR, had represented the movement that ousted Aristide as having widespread support, as representing the majority of the population. But again, what this poll exposes is that it's less than 30% of the population, and the major candidate representing the movement that ousted Aristide, Charles Henry Baker, is polling at 10%. So obviously, they pulled the wool over a lot of people's eyes. And of course, now the press is going to, you've seen that their reporting has started to change. They've actually begun to refer to the movement that ousted Aristide as an elite-led movement, that it was a movement that was led by Haiti's small, wealthy elite. Well, that's not enough, because really, they were the ones who participated in misrepresenting and misportraying that movement as having widespread support, when in fact it was very marginal and did not represent the majority of the Haitian people.
Now, can we count on the votes being counted properly, correctly, honestly?
You know, I don't know what we can count on at this point. It's being overseen by the Organization of American States. And let's not forget that it was the OAS who were the ones who cast a pall, a taint of illegitimacy over the 2000 parliamentary elections in Haiti. They had said that there were 8 seats that were not supposed to have won outright, but rather they were supposed to go to a second runoff election because no one had won 51% of the vote. And because of that, and I remember this was 8 seats out of 7,500 elected positions, the Organization of American States back then cast a pall of illegitimacy over that entire election. So I don't count on the OAS to be impartial by any stretch of the imagination. And let's also not forget that that same year, as the parliamentary elections in Haiti in the year 2000, they turned a blind eye to Alberto Fujimori just outright stealing the elections in Peru. So if it's a government that U.S. foreign policy can accept, they will turn a blind eye. They will find a way of negotiating quietly behind the scenes any discrepancy. If it is a government that they perceive as being opposed to U.S. foreign policy, they have no problem at all casting a pall of illegitimacy over the process.
Well, of course, we've had some changes in the leadership of the Organization of American States, so maybe, hopefully, there will be some more consideration for true democracy in Haiti. In terms of...
Well, I don't, you know, Miguel Insulza, I mean, look, we've got Lula's government here. Lula's supposed to be a big progressive, and yet we've got the Brazilians who've been backing up a regime that has committed gross human rights violations. Lula, it's quite clear that Lula would rather have Brazilian soldiers here shooting at Haitians than back at home giving his own people trouble.
Preval, Rene Preval has said that if he is elected, he will allow President Aristide to return, and this has really caused turmoil among the opposition to Aristide.
Well, what's interesting is that most of the people in the poor neighborhoods that I interviewed yesterday, and I interviewed a lot of them, did not see a vote for Preval as necessarily voting for Preval, as choosing Preval as the next president, as much as it was a vote for Aristide's return. There was an earlier poll in November that was commissioned by an organization that's very hostile to Aristide and Lavalas. It was run by an organization called the Democracy Group, and that poll showed that 51% of the respondents supported the return of President Aristide to Haiti. They're running against the grain here, but of course, really what yesterday's vote is really a referendum on that question more than it is to elect a president.
Well, what role has... In this election, have the old criminal elements that the U.S. encouraged before the overthrow of President Aristide, what role have they been playing in this?
Well, they've been legitimized. They've been rehabilitated. Their image has been rehabilitated. You've got Guy Philippe, who was a former member of the Haitian police, who was accused of being involved in drug trafficking by the DEA in 2000. He ran as a candidate for the presidency yesterday. He was the one who led the paramilitary forces, the former death squad leaders and former brutal military into Haiti to attack and take over several townships, which of course the United States government later used as justification to oust Aristide, saying that if Aristide stayed, there would be a bloodbath, which of course was ridiculous in itself. Then you've got people like Danny Toussaint, former Lavalas Senator Danny Toussaint, who went over to the opposition, and before he went over to the opposition, of course, everyone said that Aristide had given the order to Danny Toussaint to assassinate Haiti's most popular journalist, John Dominique, for those of you who've seen the film The Agronomist by Jonathan Demme. Well, of course, once Danny Toussaint went over to the so-called opposition against Aristide, they never said another word about it. They dropped the entire thing, and Danny Toussaint also was running as a candidate for the presidency yesterday in Haiti.
That's interesting. Of course, none of this gets reported here in the mainstream media. It's like a blanket of information control, and then you have these kind of folksy interviews with people that don't really give the background or the history of the situation down there, with the long history of U.S. intervention. I've seen statements by former Haitians or expatriates saying the United States has to go back and really help again. A U.S. congressman, a U.S. senator says, well, it's the United States to go and help the Haitian people. We've done it several times since the last 100 years. How big is the U.S. presence down there as part of the U.N. presence?
Oh, hell, you've got representatives from the U.S. Embassy who are the ones who are overseeing the vote count in several large centers in the capital and in the countryside. That just came out. I just saw that in a report from Australia where they inadvertently let slip out that there was a representative of the U.S. Embassy who was overseeing the vote count in Cité Soleil, of all places. They're everywhere. I mean, you know, this is this entire policy, this entire charade has been being run at the behest of U.S. foreign policy in the region. There is nothing that can happen in this region without the blessing of U.S. foreign policy. I mean, all we've got to do is historically look at the examples of popular democracy and popular democratic movements in the hemisphere, whether that be 1954 and the popular democratically elected government of Jacobo Arbenz being overthrown in a CIA-engineered coup, whether that be Juan Bosch in the Dominican Republic in 1965, whether that be Salvador Allende in Chile in 1973, and of course the most current example being Jean-Bertrand Aristide being overthrown by U.S. foreign policy, and now of course we've seen an attempted coup against the democratically elected populist government of Hugo Chavez, and current maneuvers to try to isolate, try to demonize, try to destabilize his government.
Well, it's interesting now with the election of Evo Morales, there have been, in fact, a number of elections in which the candidate supported by Washington has been defeated. And this seems to be a positive sign. How do these elections play in Haiti? Do they? Because it seems so often that Haiti is like separated from every other political struggle, like it's out there by itself. The people there are alone to conducting the struggle. That because it's not a Spanish-speaking country, it doesn't have the same role in Latin America or seen as being part of Latin America. Is that a problem?
You know, and I also think that's the press. And, you know, I also think it's a lot of the political pundits. They like to look at Haiti as somehow otherworldly and somehow not subject to the same rules of U.S. foreign policy as the rest of Latin America and the Caribbean. However, that's absolutely not true. Haiti has been part of that history. Let's not forget that the longest occupation by U.S. military forces in the history of the U.S. military was in Haiti from 1915 to 1934. And we know that was during a similar period of occupations throughout Central America and throughout Latin America and the Caribbean by United States Marines. Haiti is part of that history, and yes, of course, people do tend to try to isolate it, do try to give it the appearance of somehow being outside of the providence of the historical movement of the rest of the region. But the truth is, if you look and study Haitian history, that is absolutely not the case.
Well, sometimes it seems that if the United States and the Western countries will not forgive Haiti for being a black revolutionary country, the country that overthrew the French colonialism over 200 years ago. And in fact, before President Aristide was overthrown, they were trying to collect a debt that they had paid to France over the years. And what happened with that?
Well, that's true. France, if you can believe it or not, the slave-holding nation who had enslaved Africans, brought them here, kidnapped them, brought them to Haiti, built tremendous wealth for France on their backs, on their debt, on their human chattel, then had the nerve in 1855 to demand reparations in order to recognize Haiti's independence. And Haiti had to pay $90 million, the equivalent of $90 million, in gold bullion to France in order to have her recognized as an independent nation. And, of course, Aristide, during his term, demanded reparations and restitution for that amount and had calculated that, I think it's today's more than $27 billion, and demanded that France cough it up. And, of course, that explains, it's one of the reasons in explaining France's visceral hatred for Aristide's government following that, and they're working closely with the United States and Canada through this myriad of NGOs, non-governmental organizations, to build an opposition, to give it the appearance of having widespread support, despite the fact that it actually did not, to then justify overthrowing a democratically elected government. Today's modern coup d'etat is not about military dictatorships in the classical sense. Today's modern coup d'etat is carried out by thousands of individuals carrying briefcases and calculators filled with tons of U.S. aid and largesse and promises in order to buy them against the interests of their own people, in order to have them serve the interests of U.S. foreign policy rather than serve the interests, the economic, the political interests of their own people. That is the modern coup d'etat. That's what Aristide faced. That's what he was overthrown by. That's what's being given against Hugo Chavez today in Venezuela.
It's a lot easier to do that because the people generally are not aroused by these visits. But the role of the NGOs have been playing all over the world has been an interesting one, because in the beginning, many of the NGOs were, of course, there for good reasons, do-gooders. But now it seems that everywhere you see, there are NGOs that are being financed by the Republican Institute, the Democratic Institute, the National Endowment for Democracy. The National Endowment for Democracy, which you mentioned, what kind of role have they played in Haiti?
Well, they've had a tremendous role. They're the ones who have been the primary funding agent for the other sort of subcontracting NGOs, such as the International Republican Institute, the National Democratic Institute, and a myriad of other non-governmental organizations. And, you know, it's so funny because a lot of these non-governmental organizations take on the mantle of doing so-called progressive work. But they're doing that progressive work within the context of receiving funding from organizations like the National Endowment for Democracy, which was created specifically to encourage politics, to shape politics, to do social engineering in Latin America and the Caribbean in order to guarantee that there would be governments shaped in our own image that would represent U.S. foreign policy interests in the region. You know, back to these elections, that's one of the reasons that these elections are not going to solve anything. Really, I mean, if Rene Préval wins these elections, there's going to be violence. The elite, who were portrayed, as I said again, as having widespread support and really don't, have made it clear that they will not accept the Préval presidency, and they see him as somehow a twin of Aristide. On the other hand, if Préval doesn't win, there's also going to be violence, because really at the base of this, it is... for want of a better term, class warfare, Jeffrey. You have the majority of the poor who live in abject poverty but are highly politically conscious now, and that can never be taken away from them. They will never again be forced into the back seat of Haitian politics. They are very conscious of wresting control away from Haiti's traditional economic elite so that they will have a say in their own future. They are very conscious of that goal. Opposed to them is a tiny elite who've been supported and backed by Washington, backed by elites in France and Canada, backed by elites internationally, who do not want to lose their power and privilege, who have always seen controlling politics in Haiti as their entitlement and their privilege. This is a battle that these elections cannot and will not solve. Either way, this country, I believe, is going to be thrown again into another period of chaos and violence. There will be attempts by the international community to forestall those contradictions by pumping in huge amounts of money, but the truth is that the very same people that they are working with to administer those monies that are coming through non-governmental organizations, that are coming through organizations of the United States, France, and Canada, are working with NGOs that are aligned with the elite. Why? Because poor people do not have the infrastructure to administrate grants. They don't have offices. They don't have desks. They don't have computers. They don't have computer skills. So what that means is that when that money is pumped through here, it will go into the hands of those people who can afford the infrastructure to administer those grants. And those are the very same people who are at the source of the contradiction, again, between the majority of the Haitian people who live in abject poverty and the tiny elite who tries to represent them and who tries to control the political landscape.
Well, you've written about the fact that there's a former filmmaker named Raoul Peck, who actually directed the film Lumumba, and he was a former minister of culture in Haiti, and he has written about opposition to Préval being elected. He calls a reconstructing the Lavalas anarchy and says under no circumstance can Préval be allowed to prevail and the people's will be allowed to prevail.
Well, this is a real interesting example. I mean, now here's the guy who produced the film Lumumba. He produced Sometimes in April for HBO. You know, here's a guy who's seen as a progressive in a lot of circles. Here's a guy who's been touted as a reasonable man. But what he's really exposed in this diatribe that he wrote, which I commented on our website, www.hadyaction.net, is that he is really a false Democrat. He is a person who is a Democrat, can call himself a Democrat and a progressive only if elections result in before a candidate that represents his political interests and his political motives. So what that means is he's not really a Democrat and he's not really a progressive. And how many people have been fooled by the reputation of others just like Raoul Peck, who were part of the movement to overthrow Aristide? Those who pretended that they were really Democrats and progressives, but now you can see who they really are, see them for what they really are. They were pretending, they were posing to be Democrats, and at the end of the day, if they don't get their way, they are willing to rely upon U.S. help to overthrow democratically elected governments.
Well, it's interesting. Well before the election, there has been a situation in which leading spokespersons for the people, like Father Jean Just, have been arrested, charged with crimes they couldn't possibly have committed. Harassment of people who supported Aristide has been manifest, and other than on the internet or papers like the San Francisco Bayview have reported that. What is the situation with Father Jean Just? And perhaps you could tell the listeners about him, because he's a hero to the people, the poor of Haiti, but he's virtually unknown outside of Haiti, except among people who support the Haitian struggle, because the mainstream media in the U.S. simply doesn't talk about him.
Well, I first met Father Jean Just. He was introduced to me by my political mentor in Haiti, Father Jean-Marie Vincent. Father Vincent was assassinated in 1994, but I first met Jean Just through Father Vincent in 1991 when he was a preacher at St. Gerard Catholic Church in the Kent. This was during the period just after the brutal military coup d'etat. A lot of thousands of people were being killed. The press was lying about it, saying that only hundreds were being killed. I was documenting those thousands of lives. Father Gerard Jean Just was a man of courage. He was a man who refused to leave Haiti during that period of time. He encouraged others to stay and to struggle against the military dictatorship. He suffered, as so many others did during that period, tremendously at the hand of the military dictatorship. Of course, now with the overthrow of Aristide, it was in February 29, 2004, Father Gerard Jean Just was a very vocal critic of that coup. He was very critical of the interim government, the so-called U.S.-sponsored interim government, particularly because of the gross human rights violations it was committing. They were murdering people in the streets. There were summary executions. There were shooting of unarmed demonstrators, attempts to plant guns in the hands of their victims to prove that they deserved to be mowed down. Of course, untold numbers of political prisoners behind bars. Father Gerard Jean Just was a vocal advocate against this regime for gross human rights violations it was committing, as well as a strong voice for the poor. Of course, he has a program for feeding the poor kids in his neighborhood, Picas Plazo. They feed 600 kids a week, three times a week. For a lot of these kids, it's the only hot meal they get. Father Gerard Jean Just was arrested three times. The third time, of course, he was held for 6 months. He was being held on bogus charges that he was somehow implicated in the killing of another journalist, Jack Walsh. Now, I don't know if people are beginning to see a pattern here about the killing of journalists and then attempting to link it to people associated with Lavalas. I certainly am beginning to see a pattern emerge. Anyway, Father Gerard Jean Just was falsely accused in that murder, in the kidnapping and murder of Jack Walsh. And, of course, those charges were dropped because they were false. But not until they kept him 6 months. Dr. Paul Farmer, for those of you who know who he is, went into the facility, met with Father Gerard Jean Just, secretly drew blood, went back to a laboratory in the United States, and diagnosed Father Jean Just with leukemia, lymphatic leukemia that would lead to a rare form of cancer. After tremendous pressure, international pressure, after my having been arrested as well September the 9th for having filmed a judge of the Justice of the Peace and a judge here, notorious judge along with the police attempting to plant guns in his rectory to justify continuing to keep him in jail. That brought a lot more attention to his case. But finally, he was released late last month. He's now in Miami. He's undergoing a brutal regimen of chemotherapy. Doctors are very optimistic that they've caught this in time, and in 6 months' time that he'll be able to pretty much resume life normally.
You mentioned earlier about the NGOs working with the elites there. One of the problems in Haiti, of course, is the level of education, and obviously it has gone down since the overthrow of President Aristide. But what's the situation at present?
Well, you know, when Aristide was first elected president in 1990 and assumed office in 1991, the illiteracy rate in Haiti, the number of people who could not read and write in the country, was at 90%. During Aristide's administration, through the administration of René Préval and Aristide's re-election in 2000, through a universal literacy campaign that was patterned after that was created by the Cubans, which the Cubans had helped the Nicaraguan people with, and several other people in Latin American and Caribbean with this literacy program, Aristide and the Lavalas government were able to reduce literacy to its current rate, which is at about 45% today. Unfortunately, with the coup that ousted Aristide February 29, 2004, the U.S.-installed government of Gerard Latour certainly made clear what its priorities were. The first ministry that they abolished was the Ministry of Literacy that Aristide had created in order to put into effect that universal literacy program.
And so today, the situation is obviously far worse.
Well, sure, it's reversing now. People, you know, that program had a tremendous impact, and of course, without it, you know, a lot of those gains are being reversed, as so many others are.
What's happened with Tarla Torture, the American appointee? What role is he supposed to play in the future? Is he still going to have a role in the government?
No. What he's supposed to do is he's supposed to go back to Boca Raton, Florida, where lawyers are waiting on behalf of the victims to bring civil class action suits against this man. This man should know, and if anybody out there has any contact with him or knows anybody who knows him, which I tend to doubt, but he should know that he's not just going to go back to Boca Raton, a wealthier man, and that people aren't going to come after him legally. We're going after him. There are a lot of people, a lot of lawyers are putting in pro bono hours right now, preparing those suits on behalf of the victims. This man better know it's coming.
Now, you've been living in Haiti for some time. So how long?
7 years.
And what took you down there initially?
Well, you know, I'm a documentary filmmaker by trade. I was one of the producers. My first film was on El Salvador, called In the Name of Democracy, about the U.S.-sponsored elections in El Salvador in 1982 that brought Jose Napoleon Duarte to power. And then I was a producer of a film called Berkeley in the 60s. I was one of the producers on that film. It was nominated for an Academy Award in 1990. And then I was one of the lead producers of another documentary called Amazonia, Voices from the Rainforest. And then I decided that I was going to make my next film about Haiti. I think what attracted me to it was this concept of liberation theology. I'm sort of having been a disaffected Catholic, but yet being a spiritual man, I was attracted by this concept within my own former faith of these people, these priests who believe that to walk in the footsteps of Jesus means to work on behalf of the poor, and especially this concept that whereas a rich man's concerned with going to heaven and how he'll be treated in the afterlife, a poor man is concerned with feeding himself and feeding his family, and then you can't so-called, quote-unquote, save a person's soul while they're starving to death. And if that means changing the structures of society to give the poor preferential treatment rather than the rich spiritually, then so be it. And I was sort of intrigued by that concept, and that's what first attracted me, plus also the amazing history, historical relationship between the United States and Haiti from its inception as the world's first black republic. You know, just little-known facts, like the U.S. Senate of 1805 declared Haiti the greatest threat to U.S. interests at home and abroad in the world, and for good reason, because it inspired famous slave revolts in the United States, such as Nat Turner, Denmark Vesey, Gabriel Prosser, John Brown. I was really intrigued and fascinated by that entire history. So I produced a film about Haiti, then afterwards I went back, you know, I'm from California, I'm an Oakland boy, born and raised, and then I decided I wanted to make a sequel to that film, which I've been working on for a long time now, called The Betrayal of Democracy, And I decided that in order to do that, I'd have to move back to Haiti, which I did. And so I've been one of the few people who've been chronicling since 1999 what's been going on in this country, particularly from a documentary filmmaker's point of view and perspective. You know, I've got hundreds of hours of archival material now that I've accumulated on the subject on Haiti, having lived here the last 7 years. And then, of course, I met my wonderful and beautiful wife, Melande, and we now have a young son who was born here, Paolo. And here I am.
Well, it's very interesting because you've had a chance to see different struggles and make comparisons between those struggles. How would you relate the situation you saw in El Salvador with that in Haiti?
A lot of similarities and a lot of differences. Of course, El Salvador was in an open civil war between the majority of the poor, and it was an armed struggle based on self-defense, but an armed struggle nonetheless. And of course, on the other side, you had the Reagan administration just outright lying about the situation, trying to link it to the Soviet Union, put it in the context of the Cold War, that somehow the evil Nicaraguan communists and Salvadoran communists are going to come over the Rio Grande and start raping white women or something. I don't know if you remember those famous white papers that Reagan had released. And, you know, then putting just hundreds of millions of dollars into a brutal, brutal military, repressive military apparatus. You know, that civil war resulted in more than 90,000 Salvadorans losing their lives. It was unnecessary. It put that country back at least 50 years. They're still recuperating from that evil that was put upon them by U.S. foreign policy and the Reagan administration. Haiti's very different. This has not been an armed struggle of that magnitude. Of course, there has been some armed resistance, but mostly small pockets of it to the U.S. Installed government. But largely, it's been a peaceful movement. It's been a nonviolent movement, although it's been portrayed as being violent in order to justify, again, to demonize Aristide, to demonize Lavalas, and to justify Aristide's overthrow. The truth is, if this were really a violent movement, we'd have a very different situation in Haiti today.
Well, one of the aspects of this struggle that is very rarely mentioned is the role the Dominican Republic, which shares the island of Santo Domingo with Haiti, has played in this in the struggle for oppression of Haiti by the United States. What role has Dominican Republic been playing lately? I know they had weapons stored there, and some of the criminal elements that came back before Aristide was overthrown were based in Dominican Republic. But what's happening now between Dominican Republic and Haiti?
I think those relationships are on hold. I think the Dominican Republic has shown itself to be a whore for U.S. foreign policy. You know, that whenever the U.S. Embassy barks, it answers. But right now it's sort of on hold. It's a base, it's a huge military base for the U.S. military, for the CIA in the region. Really, I don't look at the Dominican Republic as a truly sovereign nation. I look at it more as an appendage of the CIA and the State Department at this point in history.
Well, I know back in 1965, after Supreme Court Justice Douglas had helped write a constitution modeled after the American Constitution, and there was an uprising there, the U.S. Marines went in to suppress the people of the Dominican Republic, and that seems to be the last political struggle that I have heard about since that time. And since that time, it has been basically a source of baseball players for Major League Baseball.
Well, you know, there was tremendous pacification. I'd mentioned that earlier. That was the overthrow of Juan Bosch in 1965, and Lyndon Johnson had landed 20,000 U.S. Marines in there.
To protect American interests, yes.
Policy, you know, it's not just Republican. You know, it's also Democrat. You know, it sort of doesn't matter who's in power from which political party. I mean, if you really want to call it a two-party, if there's anything that proves it's not really a two-party system, but a one-party system, it's that there's a single U.S. foreign policy, regardless of which of these Neanderthals are in office at any given time. You know, the Dominican Republic right now, as I said, I don't. There are struggles that are going on there, particularly labor struggles. There are labor unions that are involved in the left there that continue to fight. But, you know, largely that country's been pacified, and there's such a presence of U.S. intelligence apparatuses in the Dominican Republic, from the DEA to the CIA to the DIA, they're all there, and the U.S. Embassy is one of the most powerful in all of Latin America and the Caribbean, in the Dominican Republic, in Santo Domingo, and, you know, those people are facing an uphill battle of reclaiming any true sovereignty.
Where can people go to get more information on Haiti? Is there a website that people can go to?
They can go to www.haitiaction.net.
That's www.haitiaction.net. And when do you think expect the election results to be made public? Or when are they expecting it?
Well, they're supposed to release early results later this evening, but the final results aren't supposed to be known until Friday. People should just hold on to their hats. This thing isn't over by a long shot.
Well, Kevin Pina, I want to thank you very much for being our guest today and Takes on the World. Take care of yourself and your family. I look forward to seeing you on your next trip to the Bay Area.
Thanks so much, Jeffrey.
Take care.